really why the book Tales to Nokomis got published was because I was a foster parent for Native children. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a TV. And so in the evenings, I would tell them the legends. And I realized that you could hear a pin drop. They were so interested in what I was saying. But you know, in the old heritage, we did not have a written language. And so this is the way we taught our children, by storytelling, because most Indian legends, there's a moral to it. And I realized then that these legends that I knew should not be lost. And so I started to write them down. And then one time I was asked to come to Toronto for an education meeting, and I had some of those legends. And the director of education at Indian Affairs saw them, and he wanted me to give them to him, but I didn't. And I thought, well, if he wants them, they must have some value. So then I became very ill, and I ended up in the hospital in Toronto General. And Dr. Rogers at the ROM and Mrs. Tracy, who was president at that time of the Indian Eskimo Association, came to me with a contract and asked me if I would sign a paper that these stories, these legends that I had written, be published. And they were published. That book, Tales of Nokomis, came out. That's how it happened. And then after that, somebody became interested in my life story, and my biography was printed. Yes. And it's called I Am Nokomis Too.
Yes, I've read that.
But there's a lot of things have happened since that time. Mm-hmm. At the time that my biography was written, I was running a boarding house in Toronto, and I ran that for almost 9 years. Mm-hmm. And the last year that I was running that boarding house, I had 20 students. And then I became ill again. And I had to give it up. And I retired and I went home. But then I was needed for so many things that I didn't stay home a year. And I came back. And then I worked at Endion House for almost 4 years. And after that, I ran a home for recovering alcoholics, Native people, as a halfway house for 2 years.
And was that in Toronto as well?
Yes. It was on Pharmacy Avenue. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many people I had there. It was a very heavy job because I was with them 24 hours a day.
Yes.
And after 2 years, I gave it up and I went back and ran a boarding house again for Native people in the city. I had students and I had other people, and Native people that had no place to go. And I've only been home, it was 5 years on the 1st of April since I moved back to Cape Croker.
How was that moving back? What was that like for you after being
for so long? It was great, because in all the time I spent in Toronto, I always went home in the summertime to renew my strength. And I've often tried to explain what it's like to people. When I hit the reserve, when I was away and living in the city, when I would hit the boundary line between my reserve and the outside, it was like I took off a heavy coat and I could relax. It really was a great feeling. And I know the first year that I was in Toronto, because all my life I made maple syrup. Every year I was in the sugar bush. And I was so homesick when I knew the sap was running that the doctors had to give me tranquilizers. My desire to be there, because all my life I had made syrup. I lived with my great-grandmother, and at the time that I was a little girl with her, we never had sap pails, we never had spiles, we had birch bark baskets and chips to tap our trees. We never used white sugar. What we did was twice during that maple sugar harvest, we made what we call the granulated sugar. And when we boiled the sap in the iron pots that the settlers brought, and when it was ready to sugar, we take it off, and it took two strong people to stir it, and we stirred it till it granulated. And then we put it away in birch bark containers, and this was our sugar for the year till next spring when we have the sugar harvest again. We never made syrup, because at that time we had no containers to put syrup in. And if you wanted maple syrup during the summer, all you did was offer these great big blocks of sugar. You would just chip it off, add water, and boil it, and you had maple syrup. So it never spoiled. We had no spoilage from it. And we have a very nice maple bush on our Cape Croker park. It's a provincial park, you know, a trailer park. And where we used to go to make syrup when I was, I can hardly remember going up there. I wasn't in school yet. And was like a little community. Everybody went there to make sugar. And I think that my people are not very far-sighted, because if I was in any position to give direction, I would turn that into a maple syrup festival place, where we would start with the birch bark baskets, come to the spiles and the sap hills, and on to the modern where they use the plastic. Can you imagine how many people would come to see that?
Well, I think of, as a teacher, I take my children to one that they created up by our Fanshawe Lake here,
mm-hmm.
and I teach very young children, and to watch how their response to seeing it done, I mean, it's a trip. I have to be sure that I book my class in early, because otherwise it's all filled, because everybody wants to go.
And the thing that they could do there was have somebody there that would be making those birch bark baskets.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Yeah, I can see it. I can see that park really develop into something so great.
And I think
for our heritage.
Yeah, and I think it's a way too. I mean, I look, at least in this area, and I don't know if it's true at your reserve, but in this area, there are not many ways that non-native people can learn in a comfortable way without intruding on native people,
mm-hmm.
about how they have lived and do live,
mm-hmm.
and to have that kind of contact where we can go to their reserves and be welcomed and see. It's always, all of the contact is too much in the city, so that it's always on the non-native.
When I lived with my great-grandmother, we never bought soap. We gathered all the oils from the raccoon and other animals, the wild animals, the hedgehogs, you know, what they call, there's lots of them now, groundhogs.
Mm-hmm.
All that fat was saved. And then we would take an iron kettle and fill it about half full of hardwood ashes, put water in there and bring it to a boil. Then we do this in the afternoon. We'd set it outside until everything settled. And in the morning, we'd pour off that lye, that hardwood ash lye, and boil it with this oil that was saved. And from that, we had what my grandmother called soft soap. And we used it in washing. We used it when we scrubbed the floors. We used it for everything. And it never became a cake soap. It was like a jelly, and we'd make kegs of it that we used, and you could have eaten off of her floor. It was so white from that soft soap that we made. I did that with her. I learned there how to process Indian corn to make it edible, and I still do it today. That was another thing I did, and the nutritionists tell me that it's great what we do, because it breaks open that corn and releases that protein and all that good that's in the corn.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can still do that. And I have taught several of the younger people at Cape Croker how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because pretty soon they won't, there's so many things, not only the old things that I'm teaching them, but things that I've done in my life,
mm-hmm.
that I've had to do. And one of them is, making pastry. Anybody on Cape Croker If there's a bake sale and I put a pie there and they know I made it, that will go first. Because I have learned how to make pastry. I worked in Niagara Falls, New York, at Niagara University, and there I made from 90 to 100 pies for a meal. And we make that pastry in 100-pound lots, 25 pounds to a lot, and then walk in fridge. Mm-hmm. So I'm not only a good cook of native foods, I'm a very good cook of other things as well. Yeah. And they still come to me because I have learned how to order. If I know the number of people, I know how to order the stuff for that many people. Which I find that most of my women don't know what to how to do it. They're either short or they're over.
Yeah.
But I have learned, and when I lived in Toronto, I was here about 20 years, I learned, I have done most of the native feasts that were here. I've done them at Centennial, I've done them at Seneca, I've done them at Glendon, I've done them at the Indian. In fact, I ran that cafeteria at the center for 2 years. In Toronto, and they still ask me to come sometimes. I was there in February and did a native meal for York and transported it from Council Fire up to the western campus of York. So I guess you know that I'm 78 years old now and I'm still able to do these things. Mm-hmm. So I think that I've been very fortunate.
I was thinking, as you were talking, it was the feeling I had was that you feel a pride.
I feel a responsibility to leave behind the things that are dying.
Yes.
So that they can live on. Yeah. And I've been in so many areas of it. Like, I worked in the fish camp with my husband. I learned how to hang nets, put the corks and lets on, set nets, mend them, dress fish, all these things I learned. I learned to work in the hay fields, I learned to cut logs, I learned to cut pulpwood and cordwood. And one winter during the Depression when I raised my children, I cut the wood for 2 stoves all winter and brought it home on a hand sleigh from the bush. Cut it down, cut it up, and brought it home on a hand sleigh. So I must have been very strong.
I think so.
As a young woman. Mm-hmm. Because there isn't many 78-year-olds on my reserve that can still do, even the younger women can't do the things that I can still do. Mm-hmm. And I never smoked, I never drank. And because of my grandmother, I used the native wild plants all my life. And she'd say, eat it, Verna. It's good for you. But she couldn't tell me why it was good for me. And this is what I'm teaching now at Ameren. The vitamins, how they are metabolized and the body uses them. And all these things I'm trying to get to them now. Because today we have a very high percentage of diabetics. And I never knew, my husband's a diabetic, this is my second husband, and I never knew that a diabetic cannot metabolize vitamin A from their food. They have to have the provitamin, which means that they have to get it from a fish, bird, or an animal, and it has already been metabolized by that animal or that fish or that bird. And so a lot of it comes from liver. Mm-hmm. A lot of it you get from fish. That's provitamin. Your body doesn't have to metabolize. And for diabetics, this is essential. A diabetic that is not having provitamin will get night blindness. Mm-hmm. And my husband already is has total night blindness because it's only when I researched, it'll be 2 years now that I researched and found out that diabetics cannot metabolize the ordinary vitamin A from their foods. But he has cataracts. He's almost blind, and he's also very hard of hearing, because it was so necessary that he have this vitamin A, this provitamin A, and I didn't know about it.
Tell me, when you're taking what you knew about native plants, and then you've obviously learned a lot too about
nutrition. Yes.
Now, how did you learn that? Did you just do your own reading on it?
Reading and research, yes. Mm-hmm. I did research.
So that your goal in doing the workshop is to blend the native and the non-native information together.
So that they'll know, because one time when I was working in the Friendship Center in Toronto, I belonged to Anishinaabe Health Resources, which is a spin-off from the Diabetic Association. And I asked that they bring in the nutritionists from University of Toronto, those girls that were going through to be nutritionists, because I wanted to know what the job that these vitamins did in our system. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't tell me. They weren't able to tell me what I wanted to know. Mm-hmm. And I was always puzzled when I'd buy multiple vitamin tablets. There was riboflavin, thiamin, and niacin. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what them things were.
Yeah.
Now I know that they're the vitamin B, in the vitamin B complex. There's 13 vitamins in that, and you have to have them together for your body to work, to correlate it, I guess you'd call it, mm-hmm. in your system so that you'll be healthy. And this is what I'm trying to get across to them people there.
What with any of the traditional native crafts, arts, areas of culture like medicine and plants, what kind of response do you see from young people? Do you see that enough of them are learning it in order to be able to carry it on?
Well, in some areas. Now, young people, even older people, because I belong to the Festival of Storytellers in Toronto, mm-hmm. and I'm considered a very good storyteller. Mm-hmm. And if I have a group of young people, I can reach them. And I can also reach the older people. Where I find it very hard is to have a mixed group. But I can bring myself down to these young children. Mm-hmm. But where there's a mixed group, this is where I have a difficulty. It's a bit difficult then.
Yeah.
But last summer, I was asked to go and demonstrate beadwork in the park. And so I went up there and I was sitting at a table doing it. And I don't know what, there were a lot of people standing around, and I didn't know the press was there. And somebody said something to me, and so I started into poetry, because it hit me that she was feeling sad about a grandchild or a great-grandchild, I don't know which it was. So, and I recited this to her. The gray dawn breaks, I turn to speak, but the bed is empty, no one sleeps. No more dark eyes full of laughter, no more smiles to light my day. I ask myself, what use am I? I slowly rise, and as I do, my mind goes back to that long hall where once I walked with measured step. My arms reach out to accept the treasure, that most precious gift of my Creator. For in that bundle, soft and warm, there lay a lovely newborn child. I live again those happy hours when fluttering eyelids opened wide to reveal two jet black pearls inside, tiny pink fingers wound with wondrous power over hands that are old and wrinkled and brown. Again, I silently pray, thank you, Creator, for the gift that you gave. The days go by, my old heart aches for one more chance to let you see that I only ask that you feel free to live your life with no regrets. So don't feel sad and shed no tears. I am proud of you now and I always will. Your life holds promise of so many things. Tomorrow, I am sure, the sun will shine for both of us with love and laughter, pride, and all the joys that make living so worthwhile. Love, Graham. And I looked up and people had tears running down their faces.
Oh my.
It was, and I didn't know there was press. And the next day, the Un Sound sometimes had a full page of my picture and part of that poem. Mm-hmm. And it said, a storyteller causes people to weep.
Where did that poem come from?
I had a great-grandchild that I took. Her mother was still going to high school when she was born. So I took her because I didn't want her to go to the children's aid. Mm-hmm. And when she was 12 and a half, her mother took her.
Oh, you must have missed her so.
Oh, that's when I wrote that. But I have written other. I started this morning with this prayer. My director at Endion asked me if I would go and open a meeting between Endion and the Native Women Manpower and the Native Women's Organization. So I said, all right. So in the morning I went down and it was held at the Holiday Inn. And I said to Millie, I said, how do you want me to open this meeting? She says, open it with a prayer. Well, I said, where's the prayer? She said, write it. And this is it. May the great spirit of our ancestors dwell here with us this day. May he open our hearts to justice and peace, where corruption and jealousies may not enter. May he teach us how to give love and concern to all people. May he guide our footsteps to the trails of our ancestors, from which we have long strayed. And when we have found them and dug away the debris of several hundred years, may we plant our feet firmly and purposely upon them, until they become a superhighway of marching feet toward that faraway sunset of peace and tranquility for all our people. May he give us the courage and the sensitivity to be able to reach out our hand and grasp those who falter or stray along the way. All these things I beg of you, Great Spirit, for my native people. May you guide our minds when we think, our hands when we write, and our mouths when we speak. And please, Great Spirit, smile with favor on all who have entered here this day. Amen. Now that prayer has gone around the world. But I don't know why I can sometimes do those things and sometimes I can't. I know I used to go out to the prisons and talk to our people there. But I was running the cafeteria at the center at the time. And I'd have to get up at 5 o'clock because I used to make breakfast. And so I said, well, they said, they're asking for you. And I said, well, I find it too difficult at my age, I said, to be working all day and then go out half the night. And they said, well, write something and we'll take it to them, we'll Xerox it. And so one day, one weekend, I thought about it. And this is what I wrote. Once more I stand, my hand outstretched, ready to wrench open the portals of my past. Why do I hesitate? Am I brave enough? Or will the flush of shame spread over my face and down my neck until my whole being is sufficed with mortification? What is left of my glorious past? No longer do I stand strong and tall with the glory of freedom shining upon my breast. No, I refuse to look. I turn away. Have I used up my allotted time? Shall I beg for a reprieve? Hark, I hear the tread of footsteps among the softly falling leaves. My whole being tingles. I listen for the chant. Will the Great Spirit guide my hand to write the story that's never been written? The good things about my people, their native values, their medicinal remedies, their native foods,